You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. It is Friday. Therefore, it is brunch with Bernie time, our hour with Senator Sanders, our national town hall meeting. Hello, Senator.
How are you, Tom?
I am great. I hope you are well, and I'm curious what's on your mind today.
Well, there's a lot on my mind. It has been a busy week in Washington, and I think a whole lot of issues are surfacing that need to be discussed a bit. There was a report this week, kind of shocking, I think, from the Census Bureau, which talks about the state of the American economy for working families. And I think, Tom, when you try to understand why people are so angry, are so frustrated at what's going on and what's not going on in Washington, these numbers tell you why. Incredibly enough, in terms of median family income, that is the family in America in exactly the middle, it turns out that family has less income today, is earning less income than they did 24 years ago.
Well, that Reaganomics thing has really worked out well, hasn't it?
But can you stop and think? 24 years. And people are now median, that middle-income family, that family right in the middle, has less income than they did 24 years ago. And that just tells you where the economy is today. The typical middle-class family has seen its income go down by more than $5,000 since 1999 after adjusting for inflation. So if people are looking around and they are seeing, gee, I got all these iPads and I got all these iPhones and we got all this robotics and we got all this computer technology, and the result is that my income is going down. I'm not seeing any gains from this extraordinary increase in productivity. Meanwhile, what we are also seeing is that the wealthiest people and the largest corporations are doing phenomenally well. We learned recently that 95% of the new income generated in this country from 2009 to 2012 has gone to the top 1%. Got that?
Right.
95% in the last three-year period that we have information for, 95% of new income has gone to the top 1%. We are seeing a greater and greater concentration of wealth and income in this country. You got the 400 wealthiest Americans now are worth a record-breaking $2 trillion, and the gap between the people on top and everybody else is growing wider. Poverty, 46.5 million, the largest number of people ever in poverty. So if you take a look at the economy in America, what's happening is pretty simple. Middle class disappearing, poverty very, very high, but the people on top doing phenomenally well. Corporate America enjoying record-breaking profits. Wall Street, after they were bailed out 5 years ago, is now doing extraordinarily well, paying their CEOs record-breaking salaries. So that's one thing that's going on. Then back in the world that I live in Washington, you're seeing my Republican friends completely ignoring this reality. So at a time when 47 million Americans have no health insurance whatsoever, their response to the healthcare crisis is to vote to repeal funding for Obamacare. Now, I am a single-payer advocate, so I think Obamacare is not my preferred choice. But if you provide health insurance for 30 million more Americans, if you do away with this obscenity called pre-existing conditions, which deny people health care, if you can lower the cost of prescription drugs for seniors by filling in that donut hole, if you make sure that kids under 26 can stay within their family's health insurance program, if you provide free screening for people, if you fund and expand community health centers all over this country, there are some very, very important parts of Obamacare that we should support. We should try to make it better. But the idea, when you have 47 million Americans with no health insurance, many others with huge deductibles, expensive co-payments, that the solution for my Republican friends is to completely defund Obamacare is totally nutso, in my view. The other point that I want to make is that I think right now people are focusing on the potential shutdown of the government, whether or not we will get a budget or a continuing resolution. And the other drama that will follow a few weeks later is whether or not we lift the debt ceiling. In terms of the debt ceiling, the issue is pretty simple. For a start, everybody should know, and I'm afraid many people do not, that we have made very significant progress in recent years in dealing with the deficit. It used to be about $1.4 trillion, now more or less it is about half of that, about $700 billion. That's still a lot of money, but we have cut the deficit in half. That is not chicken feed. That's some real gains in that area. The crisis that we face now, to my mind, is not the deficit, but it is that 14 million people, 14% of our population, remain unemployed or underemployed, that real wages for millions of Americans have gone down, that we have a minimum wage barely over $7 an hour, which is totally inadequate. So the real challenge that we face right now is creating millions of jobs, and there are a lot of ways that we can do that, raising wages in this country, changing our trade policy. But the time now is to focus on the economy and jobs and income and wealth and income inequality, not simply be obsessed with the deficit. Now, in that regard, my Republican colleagues over in the House yesterday voted to cut some $39 billion over a 10-year period for food stamps, for the SNAP program. Everybody should know that 85% of the people who receive food stamps are either children, and we have the highest rate of childhood poverty in the industrialized world. Almost 22% of our kids live in poverty. Their parents often are working people trying to take care of a family at $8, $9, $10 an hour, which you can't do. They are people with disabilities. They are senior citizens. Those are the 85% of the people who are receiving food stamps. And our Republican friends who don't have the guts to take on Wall Street, they don't have the guts to take on corporate America who sends our jobs to China, they don't have the guts to take on those companies who are destroying unions, they're very tough when it comes to taking on poor people. My God, they are just also courageous. And I think that is pretty pathetic. The other point that I would make is that while a lot of attention is going to be focused on the budget and seeing whether or not there's going to be a government shutdown on October 1st, and whether or not we lift the debt ceiling so that for the first time in the history of America, we do not default on our debts and drive the entire country and world economy into chaos, because when the largest economy in the world suddenly refuses or doesn't have the ability to pay its debt, it's going to cause national and international chaos. But it is also important to focus on really what some of these Republicans have in mind, what their end game is. And their end game is not simply not raising the debt ceiling or shutting down the government. It really goes beyond that. And I had my staff do a little research, Tom, and we looked at the platform of the Texas Republican Party. And we did that because Texas is obviously a very large state. It is a conservative state, very conservative Republican governor. And it was important to know that what happens in Texas, the ideas discussed in Texas, really end up becoming mainstream for Republicans. So in a minute, maybe we'll talk a little bit about where the future lies for our right-wing Republicans and really what they want to do to America.
Yeah, I would love to hear that. And that's probably why Rick Perry's running those obnoxious ads here in Maryland about, you know, y'all come to Texas. We'll be right back with more Senator Sanders.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour, our national town hall meeting with Senator Bernie Sanders, taking your calls right here on the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome back. 20 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour. And Bernie, yesterday on the radio, I was wondering out loud, why am I seeing these ads where Rick Perry is running ads in Maryland, which is right next door to Washington, D.C. here, so we see them on our TV shows, saying, come on down to Texas. We got to figure it out. This state knows how to run things.
Yep.
What's the deal?
Well, here's what let me just talk a little bit about Texas and the Texas Republican Party platform. And the reason I mention that is not to just focus on Texas, is this is obviously one of the largest states in our country, one of the more important states. But equally important, the ideas that often emanate from the Texas Republican Party very often become mainstream for the Republican Party nationally. They kind of morph their way all over the country. I want to just read some excerpts. This is not Bernie Sanders talking. I'm reading some excerpts that come from the 2012 Texas Republican Party platform. And I read these things so that people understand where our right-wing friends are coming from. It's not just a question of shutting down the government. It's not just a question of cutting food stamps. This is where they want to go. They say, and I quote, "We support," this is quote, "we support an immediate and orderly transition to a system of private pensions based on the concept of individual retirement accounts and gradually phasing out the Social Security tax." End of quote. What does that mean? We're going to get rid of Social Security. We've got over 50 million people in this country now on Social Security. It has gone a long way toward lowering poverty among seniors. It has been there in good times and bad. They want to destroy Social Security, and for those people who have the money, they can invest in Wall Street, okay? Furthermore, quote, and this should be of interest to veterans, especially those veterans who are getting pretty good health care right now at the Veterans Administration, quote, "We support the privatization of veterans' health care," okay? Well, that speaks for itself. In other words, they want to abolish veterans' health care, probably want to give these guys vouchers, and good luck to them. Then the next point they make, quote, "We support abolishing all federal agencies whose activities are not specifically enumerated in the Constitution, including the Departments of Education and Energy." Well, the world is struggling now with the planetary crisis of global warming. We need a strong energy department to help the United States lead the world in transforming our energy system away from fossil fuel to sustainable energy and energy efficiency so we could save the planet. And their solution is abolish the Department of Energy. Right now in this country, as many working families know, we have a major crisis in terms of affordable child care. What they want is, quote, "We oppose mandatory kindergarten," end of quote. Quote, "We believe the Environmental Protection Agency should be abolished," end of quote. We, quote, "We recommend repeal of the 16th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution with the goal of abolishing the IRS and replacing it with a national sales tax collected by the states," end of quote. What does that mean? It means substantially lower taxes for the rich and large corporations, higher taxes for working people. "We believe," next quote, quote, "We believe the minimum wage law should be repealed," end of quote. Republican platform, state of Texas, 2012. "We believe the minimum wage law should be repealed." Now, right now, people don't know this. We're having a debate. Some of us believe that at 7 1/4, minimum wage is much, much too low. We've got to raise the minimum wage. Some people say yes. Some people say no. Most people think we should raise the minimum wage. What these guys believe is we should abolish the concept of the minimum wage because, Tom, we're interfering with the freedom of workers and employers to mandate that at least people have a minimum wage. And what these guys literally want, and everybody should know this, is that in high unemployment areas where workers are forced to compete heavily against each other for jobs, under their future, under this right-wing future, people will be working for $3 or $4 an hour because there will be no floor on wages. You can pay anybody anything you want. They want the government out of that area. So in other words, what this closing the government is out, shutting down government, this debt ceiling debate, this is only the window trimming for a much deeper right-wing ideology, which essentially wants to bring us back to the days where we have abolished, where we abolished every single piece of legislation passed in the last 80 years to protect workers, to protect low-income people, to protect children, to protect senior citizens, to protect the sick, all gone. And we're back to a day where a handful of billionaires control the economy, control the political life of the nation, because with Citizens United, these guys can buy and sell politicians. And if you are poor and desperate, Maybe you can get some charity if people have a mind to give you some charity, or maybe not. And that is their future for America. So people should understand that when you see a $39 billion cut for food stamps, that's just the beginning of their attack. When you see their willingness to shut down government, well, that should be no surprise. These guys don't very much believe in the concept of government. So that's kind of where we are.
That is astounding. Bernie, we have just a little less than a minute, not enough time to bring a caller in. Can I share with you a couple of sentences from Dwight Eisenhower's 1956 Republican platform?
Yep.
This is Republican platform, 1956 Dwight Eisenhower. The record of performance of the Republican administration on behalf of our working men and women goes still further. The federal minimum wage has been raised for more than 2 million workers. Social Security has been extended to an additional 10 million workers and the benefits raised for 6.5 million. The protection of unemployment insurance has been brought to 4 million additional workers. There have been increased workmen's compensation benefits for longshoremen and harbor workers, increased retirement benefits for railroad employees, and increased wages and improved welfare and pension plans for federal employees. And they go on. He goes just on and on about all these progressive things.
That is really, really interesting.
That was my dad's Republican Party.
That is really, really interesting, because this shows you the transformation of American politics and the growth, the ascendancy of right-wing extremism in this country. There is virtually no Republican who would adhere to the list of programs that you just
said. Yeah. There, in fact, they say, we must assure equal pay for equal work, regardless of sex. This is the 1956 Republican presidential platform. It's incredible. Senator Sanders will be taking your calls when we come right back. It's 28 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
It is Brunch with Bernie. Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls right after this break. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour here on the Tom Hartman Program. Ready to pick up some phone calls, Bernie?
Let's do it.
Okay, Marcia in Angier, North Carolina. You are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, thank you. Senator Sanders, I wanted to ask if it's possible to do single-payer health care in stages, I guess is the way to say it. And let me explain real quick what I mean. In general, working people are paying so that people who are very poor can have Medicaid, and working people are paying so that people who are disabled can have it. And I'm trying to figure out if we could just pay the same amount that is coming off of our checks for that to provide for those of us who want it. For those working people who want it. And the reason I'm asking that is so that we could present it as, well, if you don't want to pay for it, you don't, the other side doesn't want to have taxes taken out. They don't have to. Just those of us who want to have the taxes taken out, we could have it taken out to cover us.
Okay, I got it. Thank you, Marcia, for your call. What you're kind of suggesting is a pick-and-choose single-payer model where people pay into a single-payer system and get the benefits of it. Is that possible? I don't know. It would be difficult to do. I think the easier approach, Masir, is what we are kind of trying to do here in the state of Vermont, and that is to become the first entire state to fund a single-payer system which would guarantee health care to all people. And I think if we can pull it off here, or if California or some other state can do it, and it works well, I think that idea will spread throughout the rest of the country. It is kind of hard at a public entity, at a public level, to say, yeah, you'll pay taxes if you want to, but you don't. That's kind of tough to do. But I would just say this as a strong single-payer advocate. 2 points to be made, Marcia. Number one, we are the only country in the industrialized world that doesn't guarantee health care to all people through a national health care program. Number two, we spend almost twice as much per person on health care as do any other nation, because our system is extraordinarily wasteful and bureaucratic. And third, our health care outcomes in terms of life expectancy in terms of dealing with the number of illnesses or infant mortality is not particularly good. So we have got to go forward. I think Obamacare is a modest step forward. We've got to go a lot beyond that, guarantee health care to all people through a single-payer system.
Detroit Johnny O in Romulus, Michigan. You're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Great, Tom. How you doing?
Good.
This is like a question with a positive ending. There's a way to create jobs. And first of all, it takes the corporations. The companies, you know, that have farmed out all these work since the 70s, overseas to Mexico, whatever. But there's a thing that someone invented. The electronic phone answering system. Do you think any corporations or employers out there would consider getting rid of that and hiring these disabled people to answer the phones again so their company would have a personal touch? Do you think that would ever come back?
Well, I'll tell you something, Johnny. You touch a sore spot for me because I go nuts personally. You know, if I have to call up the airlines or anybody else and they got a damn tape recorder at the other machine at the other end, and it really is, I think, I don't know, maybe it's just me. Oh, me and you. But I think it is humiliating for a human being having to have a discussion with a bloody machine there. I agree with you. I think in my office we have always had a human being answer the phone, somebody who is compassionate, who is understanding, and I will never use a tape recorder, you know, other than on weekends or after hours. So I think that's a great idea. And I think a lot of people, you know, I don't know, I have been on phone calls where they say, okay, now, if you want to speak to somebody, give me the last, you know, their last name first and their first name last and the first three initials of this and that and the other thing. You know, and if you're elderly and you try to work a phone, you can go nuts, you know, trying to make that connection. So I think Johnny's point is a great point. I think companies would be very well served and people would appreciate having a knowledgeable human being at the end of the phone, and we can create jobs doing that rather than having some stupid machine. But that is my opinion.
And it's shared, Bernie. When you said that damn machine, Jim, our video guy, Shano, our audio guy, they both pumped, you know, high fives in the air. You know, everybody, there you go. We all
just dial the first, you know, first three, you know, and you know, yeah,
it's crazy.
Something going on.
It's crazy.
Really,
yep. Yep, yep. Okay, Aaron in Los Angeles, you are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yes, Senator Sanders, my question is, do you think that the Affordable Health Care Act can ever offer in-home care to disabled and elderly people? Currently, in-home services, you're only eligible if you're eligible for Medi-Cal, the state Medi-Cal. And the private companies are really expensive. They charge like $15 to $25 an hour with the minimum of 4 hours. So I guess my question is, will the Affordable Health Care Act ever include in-home care to elderly and disabled?
Well, Aaron, that's a very good question on a very important issue. And obviously it depends on who controls the Congress and where we go forward on health care. Do we expand and improve Obamacare, or do we abolish it? And if we expand it and improve it, that is certainly one of the areas that we want to take a look at. Very important area. But I will tell you something, Aaron, which is interesting. I'm chairman of the Veterans Committee, and just a couple of years ago, before I was chairman, the Congress passed what we call the Caregivers Act. And the Caregivers Act helps often wives or mothers or relatives who are taking care of disabled vets at home. And we see that it's a cost-effective way to keep folks out of nursing home and provide them with quality care. And I got legislation in that we're moving forward on, which would greatly expand that program. So I think it's an important idea. There are a lot of people who are in their homes who need help, who don't want to end up in a more costly, uncomfortable nursing home, rather stay at home, and we've got to move forward in that area.
Kathy in Santa Cruz, California. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Well, good morning. Thank you, Senator Sanders, for what you're doing for us. And my question is, after the debt ceiling problem and the October 1st possible shutdown, what are the likelihood of having more emphasis on the infrastructure to employ people? And also, what is happening with the post office?
Okay. Good question on two issues that I am involved in. Kathy, as I mentioned a few minutes ago, to my mind, the crisis facing this country right now clearly is the collapse of the middle class, the fact that we have 20 million Americans who are either unemployed or underemployed. As I think you imply, if we're serious about creating jobs, one way you do that is by rebuilding our crumbling infrastructure. And infrastructure is a fancy word for roads, bridges, sewer systems, water systems, rail, school construction, and all of those elements in our society which make things happen. They're the foundation, the physical foundation of society. Right now, the American Society of Civil Engineers tells us that we need several trillion dollars of work. And when you invest in infrastructure, you make your country more productive. If you have a good rail system, you're keeping cars off of our highways, stopping pollution, making it possible for people to get to airports rather than having to get to where they want to go without having to get on a plane. They could go by train, et cetera, et cetera. And most importantly, that is the fastest way that you can create jobs. So I am strongly supportive of rebuilding our crumbling infrastructure, and when you do that, we can put millions of people back to earth. In terms of the post office, is an issue I have been involved in quite a lot in the last few years. The issue here is to prevent the post office from shrinking significantly, from shutting down rural post offices and delivery plants, slowing down mail service, and in the process cutting 100,000 jobs from the Postal Service. I believe that a good postal service can do well economically. In fact, right now, without the onerous, horrendous burden of having to pay $5.5 billion every single year into future health retiree fund, which only the Postal Office has to do. No other entity in the United States has to do anything like that. Without that, the Postal Service would probably be making some money right now. So we've got to get rid of that burden. We've got to give the Postal Service flexibility to figure out how they can make money, and in some areas they're doing pretty well. So the answer is we're going to work very hard on that. There is a bill that was proposed by the chairman and ranking member in the Senate, which is a very bad bill, and I'm organizing opposition to it. So the goal is to make the Postal Service relevant to the 21st century, save jobs, and help our economy by having a strong Postal Service.
Bernie, we just have about 15 seconds. What can people do to support that effort?
Get them on the call up your Senate or House office. Ask them to support the legislation that I've introduced on postal reform.
So support Bernie Sanders' legislation.
Absolutely.
On postal
reform. A whole lot of co-sponsors right now. I think I don't know where we are. We're pretty high up, but
right.
We could use some more.
But not just any legislation, the one that Senator Sanders
proposed. Absolutely.
You got it. Okay.
That's the strongest bill out there.
There you go. Senator Bernie Sanders with us. He'll be back in just a moment taking more of your calls on Brunch with Bernie, our national town hall meeting here on the Tom Hartman program. Be sure to check out Bernie's website, by the way, sanders.senate.gov.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And Bernie's got his website has kind of a new look to it. It's a lot of great stuff there. Be sure to check it out, sanders.senate.gov. Welcome back. It's Brunch with Bernie here on the Tom Hartman Program. Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls. And Frank in Cambridge, Mass., you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Oh, thank you very much. I think at this time you should call it Coffee Break with Bernie.
Indeed.
I think you're right.
Because I wanted to commend you. I heard when I first turned you on that you were going down to one of the Carolinas to give a speech.
Yep.
And I thought about this, actually. I wrote a letter to one of the congressmen or one of these about why not getting the Progressive Caucus people with intelligent and people who are knowledgeable spokesmen to spread out and spread the word. Now, I live in Cambridge, and Cambridge is a very diverse community, and people here just don't know what's going on, especially now with the Obamacare. And I think that what you should set it like as a model, and I wonder if you could inspire other progressives to go out and just, you know, spread out, you know, like a local school, you know, rent an auditorium, get an auditorium.
Well, Frank, I think you make a good point. And the truth of the matter is there are many parts of this country where people have never heard an alternative point of view from right-wing extremism. They turn on the radio and they get Rush Limbaugh and those guys. They listen to their senators or their members of Congress and they get, you know, right-wing stuff. And they have never heard an alternative point of view. And that is certainly true of you know, many places in the South where, compared to the rest of the country, wages are often lower, health care is less accessible, and people are in a whole lot of hurt. So one of the reasons I'm going to go down to those states is just to see if we can raise a little bit of consciousness and get some people moving. There's some, you know, great folks down there, and I want to see if we can make some contacts and work with them. I also very much believe in the concept that that a former governor of Vermont talked about, Howard Dean, and that is a 50-state strategy. I do not accept this red state, blue state division. I believe that every state is dominated by working families. In virtually every state, families are hurting today because of the state of the economy. And I think we have to reach out to people all across this country to get them to stand up to this right-wing ideology, which is becoming so pervasive, and to begin to make government start responding to the needs of working families in terms of health care, creating jobs, making college affordable, protecting our environment, et cetera. So I think we got to, I think Frank makes a good point. I think we've got to get out all over this country and start raising consciousness.
Pat in Camas, Washington, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Good afternoon. I'm calling because I was hoping the senator would once again talk about the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And I was curious, does it promote offshoring jobs? And does it prohibit labeling food, particularly?
All right, Pat, thank you very much. And Tom, I think Pat has asked a very important question. Let's kind of put it on our agenda. Maybe at the beginning of the program, we'll talk about it at some length. Bottom line is, you know, Tom and I have talked about trade agreements a whole lot. And the TPP is in line with other trade agreements that I think are going to be harmful to the middle class and working families of this country. They're going to make it easier for jobs to go from the United States to Vietnam and other countries, make it easier for the pharmaceutical industry to charge outrageously high prices in countries where people don't have a whole lot of money, make it easier for the global economy to prevent states or nations, in fact, from protecting their own interest because of an international agreement, whether it's environmental or labor or whatever it may be. This agreement is now being worked on behind closed doors, except for many of the large corporations who seem to have access to what's going on. So it is an issue that it needs a whole lot of public discussion. And, Tom, let's put that on the agenda as something that we should get into a greater length in the future.
Okay. Deanna in Leesburg, Missouri. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, Tom. I wanted to ask Senator Sanders about the statement he made for Texas and their constitution for the Republican Party or their platform. Wanting to do away with the minimum wage, isn't that just another way to reinstate slave labor?
Well, Diana, I would tend to agree with you. And here's what it's about. You know, when you pass laws to protect workers, whether it's workplace safety, to say that people, for example, should not have to work with dangerous equipment and lose their fingers or their arms, or when you have a minimum wage that says if somebody in this country is going to be working, they can't be paid a slave wage. They got to be paid at least a minimum wage. If you do away with that and you're in high unemployment areas where people desperately need work, what do you think employers are going to do? They're going to pay as little as possible. Do I think that there are areas in this country right now where people would have to work for wages even below 7 1/4 an hour, which is the federal minimum wage, there are. And if the economy gets worse, more people will be placed in that position. So people will be working for almost nothing. They'll be working for wages by which they can't even begin to take care of their families. To take, you know, they'll be earning just barely enough to stay alive. So you can call it what you want, but clearly for workers it will be an absolute disaster. But I want people to know. People say, oh, this is a crazy idea. It's not going to happen in America. Most, to the best of my knowledge, most members, Republican members of the U.S. Senate, now support that concept. And that is in the platform of the Republican Party of the state of Texas. That is what they are talking about. So it's not a question of, you know, Tom, I think you were reading a statement from the Republican Party under Eisenhower.
Yeah, 56 in his re-election.
Raising the minimum wage, right?
Yep, he bragged about it.
They bragged about raising the minimum wage, and now, you know, 55 years later, you got Republicans who want to abolish the concept. That is what is happening, and American people need to understand.
Extraordinary. Senator Sanders, thanks so much for being with us again today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Great having you. Be sure to check out Bernie's website at sanders.senate.gov. We'll be right back with Anything Goes Friday and my little rant about the difference between the Navy Yard shooter and the House Republicans.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to the second hour of our program. So the president today, in response to the House Republicans passing a continuing resolution that would continue to fund the government, sequester in place and all that kind of thing, for until December 15th, for another, what, is that 70-some-odd days, something like that? 40-some-odd days. No, I think it's 70-some-odd days. The president says, they're trying to mess with me. You bet. But the real question in my mind is, what is the difference? And maybe you've got some thoughts on this. What are the differences? What is the difference between the crazy guy who went shooting people, the murder-suicide guy in the Navy Yard, or others of his type, people who are delusional and suicidal and they want to take other people down with them? What's the difference between them and the House Republicans? Now, that may sound like an overblown and hyperbolic statement. Like, what, you're comparing somebody who's actually killing people to politicians? Yes. BBC headline. Wednesday, 18 September 2002. More suicides under conservative rule. Australian team looked at statistics for New South Wales from 1901 to 1998. Quote, they took out World War II and other things like that. They said, after adjusting for these factors, the figure, this is the BBC. The figures clearly showed the highest rates of suicide occurred when both conservative, state, and federal governments were in power. Conversely, the lowest rates occurred when state and federal governments were both Labor. Labor, of course, is the Liberals. The last paragraph of the article. Overall, they say the figures suggest that 35,000 people would not have died had the Conservatives not been in power during the 20th century. 35,000 people. Now, that was the BBC, and that was a study about the 20th century. What about right now? This from the Center for American Progress's blog, Think Progress, September 20th. That's today. Headline, study. The Great Recession caused a sharp rise in suicides around the world. They looked at 54 countries in 2009, the year before the Great Recession hit. I'm quoting from Tara Culp-Ressler. In 2009, the year before the Great Recession hit, they found that a 37% higher unemployment rate was linked to a 3.3% increase in men's global suicide rate. The majority of the additional deaths took place in the 18 countries of the Americas, because we don't have the strong social safety net here in North and South America like they do in Europe, in Northern Europe, for example. The majority of the additional deaths took place in 18 countries in the Americas, where the unemployment rate rose by up to 101%. In those nations, the overall suicide rate rose by 6.4%, nearly double the global average. The U.S. suicide rate, because our social safety net really sucks, the U.S. suicide rate increased four times faster between 2008 and 2010. So, the Navy Yard shooter was only able to kill what, 10, 12 people? These Republicans in the House of Representatives, I guarantee you, if they throw 4 million families off food stamps, consider, as Senator Sanders just said on this program, 85% of the people getting food stamps are either children, elderly, or disabled. Children or their or the parents of children, elderly or disabled. You throw 4 million people off food stamps this year, and another couple million every year for the next 10 years, and you are going to see families fall apart. You're going to see domestic violence go up. I mean, you're taking $100 a month, basically, out of people's budgets who are already living on such an edge that many of them are living in their cars, in tents, in homeless shelters. And you're going to take $100 a month out of their budgets. You're going to see an increase in suicide. You're going to see an increase in homicide. You're going to see an increase in spousal abuse. You're going to see an increase in child abuse. You're probably going to see an increase in things like workplace deaths. The House Republicans are killers. And I defy them to prove to me that I'm wrong. This behavior that these Republicans are doing, simply because they don't want Obamacare to go into place, because they know if it does, people are going to love it, and President Obama will become even more popular. Taking food out of the mouths of hungry people, taking money out of the budgets of poor people, in order and holding the entire government of the United States hostage to try to prevent Obamacare from going into effect over the next 4 months, or 6 months, 5 months, whatever it is murderous. These people are killers. Let's call them what they are. You want a death panel? It's called the Republican Caucus in the U.S. House of Representatives. They are causing or planning on causing. They are engaging in behavior that will lead to deaths in the United States. And you've got 113 years of history to prove it, where science has actually done the real numbers. We're seeing all these Republican efforts that are all geared toward making the economy bad, that, you know, track back to this meeting that they had in the caucus room restaurant the night that President Obama was inaugurated back in January 2009, where Paul Ryan, Eric Cantor, Kevin McCarthy, Pete Sessions, Jeb Hensarling, Pete Hoekstra, Dan Lundgren, Jim DeMint, John Kyle, Tom Coburn, John Ensign, and Bob Corker got together with Frank Luntz and Newt Gingrich. And Newt Gingrich admitted it on this program and basically swore a blood oath to each other to block everything Obama was going to try to do so that he would have an unsuccessful presidency. In fact, as Congressman Sessions says, that they took a lesson from the Taliban. Killers learning from killers. Taliban insurgency, Pete Sessions said. We understand perhaps a little bit more because of the Taliban. Insurgency is the way they went about systematically understanding how to disrupt and change a person's entire process. We need to understand that insurgency may be required when dealing with the other side, the Democrats. If the Democrats don't give us these options and opportunities, then we will become the insurgency. I think insurgency is a mindset and an attitude that we're going to have to search for and find ways to get our message out. Kevin McCarthy, who was at that meeting, went even farther. He said, we've got to challenge them on every single bill, show united and unyielding opposition to the president's economic policies. These are the guys, same guys who had no problem saying yes to Bush Cheney on the stimulus, on Bear Stearns, on AIG, on TARP 1 in September of 2008, on TARP 2 in October. Of course, that was all under a Republican president. Two wars. But feeding hungry children? No, we can't do that. What is the difference between the Navy Yard shooter? Well, you say he was hearing voices in his head. You think these guys don't hear voices from the Koch brothers? Well, he was delusional. He was crazy. These guys are talking about bringing the government of the United States to his knees. They're not delusional. It may be a different kind of mental illness. It might not be in the DSM. But it's a mental illness. And it's a mental illness that has, as its consequence, the death of human beings in the United States of America. It's the killer Congress. It's not the do-nothing Congress. It's the killer Congress. And somebody needs to say it out loud. 15 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So, you think I've gone a step too far? I don't think so. I think I've just gotten started. Defending America from the weapons of mass deception. Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back. And Donna in Palatine, Illinois, listening to WCPT. Donna, what's up?
Hi. I just wanted to make a point that I think we need, when we talk about food stamps, we need to be comparing it to the three martini lunches more frequently, mm-hmm. and how these rich middle-class, upper-middle-class people can go out, have these fabulous meals, and write it off.
Yep.
And, I'd like to know how much money there is costing the government for them doing their write-offs.
Yeah, one of the Democratic members of Congress pointed out that one of her Republican colleagues, and my apologies, I just read the story once yesterday, so I don't remember the names of these people, but one of her Republican colleagues had gone on a junket of some kind to some resort that was paid for by a big corporation, and in 6 days he had eaten more food that was worth more money than food and wine, food and drinks, that was worth more money than an entire year's worth of food stamps. So, I mean, that's where that's going. So, Donna, excellent point. The Republicans have no problem with business people writing off 3, 4, 5, 6 martini lunches, but money for poor people? No, can't have that. Can't have that. Even if they're the working poor, even if they're working 2 jobs, 3 jobs, 4 jobs, it doesn't matter. They don't. If they're not rich, they're not contributing to Republican Party candidates, then to hell with them. Mark Taylor Canfield in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Mark, you got a GMO labeling battle in your state, in Washington State?
Yes, we do, Tom. It's a huge story. First, I want to give a shout-out to all the folks in New York City that celebrated the second anniversary of the Occupy Wall Street movement. So,
indeed.
Kudos to everybody for keeping those issues going. But yeah, the breaking story is that there's a group called Moms Against Labeling, which supports the Initiative 522 campaign in Washington State to label GMOs. And they have taken the no on 522 campaign to court, claiming that there's a violation of Washington State's public disclosure laws because they've failed to release the information about some of their donors, including allegedly the Grocery Manufacturers Association, which, of course, put millions and millions of dollars into California to fight that GMO.
Okay, so let me back up a little bit here for people who may not know what you're talking about in the state of Washington. You have a ballot initiative in the state which requires that genetically modified foods be labeled, correct? And it's ballot initiative 522?
Yes.
Okay, that's number one. And then number two, there's a group called No on 522 that has apparently been funded by many probably out-of-state interests as well as in-state interests, and they're saying, vote no on this thing. We don't need no stinking labeling. And they're being sued because they're not divulging who's giving them their money, right?
Yes. It's yeson522.com is the website that has the information about what's going on in Washington State.
Cool.
Actually, Dr. Vandana Shiva was here last week at a major gathering at Town Hall, so I got to interview her for Free Speech Radio News. And she's saying that Initiative 522 in Seattle, or in Washington State, actually, it's a statewide ballot measure that's coming up in November. She said that it has precedent-setting potential for the rest of the planet, and that it's a very, very important issue. She's saying that in order for people to even be educated about what they're eating and the health effects of what they're eating, first they have to be able to know what they're eating. So it's a basic consumer's right.
Yep, absolutely. Very well said. Mark, thanks a lot for the heads up on that. Michael in Brookline, Massachusetts. Hey, Michael.
Hi. I have 2 points. Let me make the first one. Bernie was on earlier, and he talked about how people outsource, and I agree with this, how outsource workers and basically pay wages to people.
Excuse me. I think that our guest said a word that you can't say on the radio, and if that's the case, my apologies to our listeners. We've nuked it off our radio stream. If it made it through to television, my apologies. Gus in New York City. Hey, Gus, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I wanted to connect the dots here on two stories that are related to the hydrofracking controversy. Mm-hmm. The first one being the fact that the rain and the flooding that Colorado has been experiencing has seeped into the hydrofracking wells there and brought up all kinds of natural and man-made chemicals that are just floating everywhere at this point.
Yeah.
I'd like to connect that to the recent announcement in Pennsylvania, where for the first time the attorney general there has initiated a lawsuit against the fracking industry because of standing wastewater that that cost people money to clean up and that polluted the surrounding environment. Now, if we take these two things together, I mean, this is a great example of I told you so, because these wells are so risky. What happens when there's a massive flood and everything comes up, and now, it's the public's problem to clean up all these chemicals, and they're going to get into every kind of, water, land, air. It's all over the place.
It's called internalize your profits, externalize your losses or your costs.
So I think we really need to applaud the Attorney General of Pennsylvania for standing up. You know, there's a state law that they're going after them because hydrofracking still is enjoying the federal exemption from the Clean Water Act.
Right, which Dick Cheney put in there personally. Yeah.
That's right. And the state laws, they can be apparently prosecuting under state law.
Yeah. And that's a fine thing. Guys, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. And thanks for listening to WWRL. We'll be right back. It is 28 minutes past the hour. It's Anything Goes Friday. So anything from chemtrails to are the Republicans really terrorists? Back with your calls. My thoughts on the news of the day right after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And you can drop into our live free chat room over at TomHartman.com. It's fun. It's free. Some of the greatest minds in the world. Talk media for the sane among us. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Our cat Higgins, by the way, just an update on our cat. Our 15, 16-year-old, I'm not sure exactly how old Higgins is, but I think it's in that neighborhood, maybe a little more. Anyhow, about 6 months ago, he just stopped eating, and he started wasting away and throwing up a lot, and we went through a bunch of different diagnoses, his thyroid, his kidneys, this, that, the other thing. Basically, they didn't know. And so Louise just said, okay, I'm going to force feed this cat. And although there's not a lot of force involved, he just sits there and she uses a 5cc syringe, without a needle or anything on it, and just squirts it into the side of his mouth. And he just, she takes the cat food and takes a good cat food. She's adding some good nutrients to it and supplements and things and puts it in a little blender and just feeds him until he just absolutely refuses to take any more and does it many times a day. And, well, there he is. That's a picture, if you're watching on TV, that's a picture I took of him this morning. As I was laying in bed, and Higgins jumped up on the bed, which he hasn't done in a week. And he's meowing, and he's behaving normally. And he's just, so he was just looking at me, and I lifted up my, I was reading my email on my phone, and so I just took his picture. So, anyhow, Higgins is still with us. And Louise is like, she's the cat whisperer, you know, she's bringing him back from the brink, you know, hopefully, you know, God willing. So we'll see. We'll see. Harry in Providence, Rhode Island. Hey, Harry, how you doing?
Tom, great to talk with you. I wanted to talk about the Republican lie that the top 1% are the makers and the people on the bottom are the takers. It's actually the reverse, as I know you've talked about before. But I'd like to come at it from a different angle.
Mm-hmm.
The Alaska Permanent Fund, as you're probably aware, has paid $800 to $2,000 a person for oil pumped out of Alaskan soil since 1988.
Right, per person per year, every man, woman, and child in the state, yes. This was Sarah Palin's... You know, when she was governor, every year she wrote the socialist check to everybody. Got it.
Exactly. Now, what if all, not just oil, but minerals, you know, the cost for broadcast airwaves and other aspects of the commons were paid in this manner? Mm-hmm. It would be tremendous. Mm-hmm. The value of the earth, the most conservative estimate, is $195 quadrillion dollars. So there's more than enough money for every man, woman, and child on this earth to have house, food, education, health care. And, you know, whether you believe this is the generosity of God, as I do, I'm a minister, or just the largesse of the cosmos, the fact is, the people on the bottom are not takers. It's not that they're sitting around on their butts and all they want is for money to be poured into their lap by the government. No, it's the obligation of government to take the resources of this nation and this planet and use them wisely so that everyone has their basic needs met.
Mm, I agree. And actually, you know, Thomas Paine wrote about this. A variation on it. He suggested that at birth, everyone should be endowed with a small fund from the federal government, which throughout their lives would grow. And so that, you know, the minimum needs would be taken care of throughout your life. And he wrote about that in Agrarian Justice back in the late 1790s. And I think your suggestion of doing the Alaska Permanent Fund on a national basis and doing it, you know, taxing the commons, basically, that part of the commons that's used by for-profit corporations, is brilliant. I think it's an excellent idea, and what it does is it puts a knife in the heart of the parasitic business model that predominates in America, which is take the public, you know, assets, whether it's the airwaves or whether it's the oil under the ground or the minerals under the ground or the oceans or the value of oceanfront property, whatever it may be. Take the public value, internalize the profits, and if there's waste like carbon dioxide from burning fossil fuels or methane from fracking or all the fracking chemicals that pile up in these giant above ground storage tanks, either as they are anticipating using them or as they are preparing to inject them back into the wells, and all of that stuff, just, you know, tax all of it, because this is their way of basically externalizing the cost, dumping the costs onto us. And that's fundamentally wrong. Harry, excellent point. Thank you for calling and making it. Ken in Green River, Wyoming, you wanna side with the frackers? Do I have that right, Ken?
Yeah, I do. That gentleman that called there from Colorado, he's full of beans. I work out in Wyoming in a gas field. And when they frack, they're in this area, they're 12,000-14,000 feet down. Now, how's that going to get, due to a flood on the surface, how is that going to release chemicals?
So how do those chemicals get 12,000 to 14,000 feet down?
Oh, it's, you ever seen a frack?
I have. They start at the surface, right? They start with tanker trucks full of chemicals, right?
Well, they've fracked with CO2, they've fracked with water, they've fracked with nitrogen.
But you've got chemicals that are mixed with that water.
What do you think, and where is the gas-bearing shale at?
And those chemicals are mixed at the surface, correct?
Yeah. And
okay.
Then what happens?
And they're stored at the surface. Well, you're suggesting that before the floods in Colorado happened, somehow the fracking industry magically and instantly took all of the toxic chemicals that they have and injected them into the ground to the depth of 14,000 feet. Is that your argument?
What do you think?
That argument doesn't make any sense.
Huh? Are they in a pond?
Whether they're in a pond or whether they're in tanks or whether they're in trucks or whatever.
Okay. And what's the flood going to do to a tank?
Well, it depends on whether the tank breaks loose or breaks open. We've seen 4,500 gallons of oil spilled so far.
And how did that happen?
It's called a flood, Ken.
Do you understand a pipeline?
I know what a pipeline is.
I'm an ultra conservative.
Apparently.
And I really like listening to you. You have some good points. But sometimes you're not, you always say it's science, but you're not looking at the science of it.
Ken, I'm not disagreeing with you that a lot of the really toxic fracking chemicals have already been injected deep underground, and in fact, in most cases, are deep underground in places where they're not even going to contaminate the water table, although that's a whole different discussion. What you're missing is that some of those fracking chemicals are above ground. They have to be there to be part of the fracking process. Somebody's got to mix that stuff up. Somebody's got to pump it into the ground. During the fracking process, there are chemicals above ground. And if you have an unanticipated flood of biblical proportions, it's bringing something like the Mississippi River through an area that isn't normally flooded. Those chemicals are going to get into that water. Some small proportion of them. And that's what that person was asserting. And the other thing that they're seeing, and the other thing that's fairly shocking, and Josh Fox, is it Josh Fox, the guy who did Gasland? Yeah, he's going to have some video coming out on this in a couple of days, is that as these gas fields are now being covered by water, what we're finding is that there's these continuous bubbling leaks of methane from these gas fields that nobody knew was there. And the methane is a much more potent greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. And you know, this should not be happening. And apparently fracking is producing a lot more leakage. You know, you've seen estimates as low as 1%, estimates as high as 6%. It obviously varies widely. But, you know, how much methane can we allow to leak into our environment before we start seeing some damage? Or another way to put the question, apropos of my earlier caller, is how much methane should we allow to leak into our environment without the fracking companies, without Halliburton at all, paying a single penny for it? Why should you and I, Ken, as taxpayers, pay for the cost of this when the fracking companies are making all the profits?
Fracking has absolutely nothing to do with gas leaking.
Fracking is all about bringing gas from under the ground to the surface.
No, it isn't. That's what you need to read up
on. So you're not fracking for natural gas. You're fracking for what? Salt water?
What is fracking? It's not drilling.
Fracking is hydraulic fracturing. It's injecting liquids or gases under great pressure into typically coal shale deposits underground, crack them open and liberate either oil or get natural gas from them. I think pretty much everybody knows that.
Okay. That's fracking. That's not drilling.
Well, you have to drill down to it to frack.
They run tubing all down this, they cement off the casing around the tubing.
Right, I know.
You really need.
I know, and that's why they've got leakage down to 1 to 6%. But 1 to 6% is still waste into our atmosphere. The oil companies are the only industry in America that dumps its trash in our backyards, in our country, and does not pay to dispose of its own garbage. And you know, I got a problem with that. Ken, thanks a lot for the call. Thanks for listening to AM760. And thanks for a respectful conversation. It's always nice to talk with a conservative who's not screaming obscenities at me 15 minutes before they come.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
So nobody has taken my bait on our House Republicans' killers. Hey. Mm-hmm. 10 minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Helping you win the water cooler wars. Tom Hartman here with you. Let's check in with Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, TalkRadioNews.com, brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom.
So what's up?
Well, as you probably know, the House passed a continuing resolution today that would lock in sequester spending, that's the automatic budget cuts, at the same levels through December the 15th. So that would mean that the government has money beyond September the 30th. It would also defund Obamacare. It passed 230 to 189 with a nearly party line vote. Only one Republican voted no, and two Democrats voted for it.
Would you happen to know the names or the states of those people?
I do. Scott Rigel of Virginia voted no, and Mark McIntyre of North Carolina and Jim Matheson of Utah voted yes.
Very interesting. Okay.
Yes.
Presumably these are people from swing districts, and they were reflecting what they perceived to be the will of their district, even though it was different than that of the party that they represent.
I believe that must be the only reason I can think of.
Yeah, okay.
The only reason I can think of. President Obama responded furiously today, speaking at a Ford stamping plant in Kansas City. He said, we're not some banana republic. This isn't a deadbeat nation. We don't run out our tab. We can't just not pay our bills. And he said he accused Republicans of threatening to blow the whole thing up because they couldn't get their way on health care. He also ridiculed them for the more than 40 votes they've taken to repeal his health care law as a waste of time and energy. He said they've gone beyond just holding Congress hostage. They're holding the whole country hostage. Also, speaking at the Ford Motor Company, he laid out a pretty serious list of consequences if Congress fails to act. And he talked about delayed paychecks for military workers. And then he also talked about what it's going to mean to the workers themselves. He said, somebody wanting to buy an F-150 truck will have to pay much higher interest rates eventually, which means you'll sell less cars. That's just one example of how profoundly destructive this could be. This is not some abstract thing. Yeah. So President certainly got into campaign mode. He also said, oh, yes, they're focused on trying to mess with me. They're not focused on you.
It's true.
So he really got into it today.
Okay.
Also today, the EPA passed new rules, draft rules anyway, because they've got to have comments yet, to represent the first limits for carbon emissions from new power plants, an essential component of President Obama's push to protect the environment through regulation and executive action, because he's not going to get anything through Congress. It's going to fuel a big political fight with the coal lobby and its supporters on Capitol Hill, including coal Democrats who reacted furiously today, a lot of fury today. Senator Joe Manchin said it's going to have devastating impacts to the coal industry and our economy. Representative Nick Rahal, these are both from West Virginia, called it callous, ideologically driven. Basically, what the EPA also said at the time, the Administrator Gina McCarthy, she pushed back at arguments that the rules represent an attack on coal. She said, we've proven time and again that setting Clean Air Act standards to protect public health does not cause the sky to fall. She said, the economy does not crumble.
Well said.
So we'll see what happens with that.
It does, however, you know, increase the cost to do business for the Koch brothers.
Exactly. And that is obviously a...
Yeah, who are funding the Tea Party and Americans for Prosperity and Generation
right.
for Prosperity and all that. Yeah, okay.
Interesting immigration development today. There is a bipartisan working group in the House of Representatives that was not known about. It was completely secret and under the radar for a few years, actually, a gang of eight. Then it became a gang of seven recently when one Republican left. Well, today it's down to a gang of five as two Republicans walked out, saying that they have a lack of faith in President Obama to enforce the current and new laws necessary to solve the immigration problem. But it's sort of like a whatever reason they gave.
Mm.
Really, the story is that the process is stalled, according to Representative Louis Gutierrez. He said, I don't believe we're going to produce a bill anytime soon.
This is in the House of Representatives, or is this?
In the House of Representatives, okay. A comprehensive immigration proposal.
Right.
Which means that they will be relying on piecemeal bills.
If that. I mean, if they can even get that. I mean, this Congress is so busy passing resolutions to either name post offices or repeal Obamacare that they don't do anything else.
Exactly, exactly. So we'll see if that goes anywhere. Senator Al Franken, Democrat from Minnesota, wrote to Apple today asking what privacy protections it plans to use with its new Touch ID technology that allows users to unlock their iPhones with fingerprints. He said, unlike ordinary passwords, fingerprints are public and permanent. If someone hacks your password, you can change it as many times as you want. You can't change your fingerprints.
That's an interesting note. So,
yes.
So somebody stole an iPhone that opens with a fingerprint, and then they simply dusted it to get your fingerprints off it, and then made a little rubber mold of those fingerprints, like you see in the 007 movies, you know, where he tries to get into the building by pretending to be the general or something. They could open the phone, right?
Well, apparently they can't do it like that because you use a different part of your phone.
I see.
But there may be other ways. Hackers are actually trying to do it now to find out what the weaknesses are. He also asked them to explain how it thinks privacy and surveillance laws, including the Patriot Act and the Stored Communications Act, apply to users' fingerprint data, and whether Apple has plans to share its data with third parties.
Well, I understand. I could be wrong, but I understand that the data is stored locally in the phone rather than sent via the cloud up to Apple. So that's part of the answer, I suppose. Although, the NSA can get inside your phone right now anyway. They can even turn it on as a listening and viewing device without your knowledge. So,
yeah.
Pretty amazing. Victoria Jones, the Talk Radio News Service, goodsfortheoldgoat.com. Thank you, or .org. Yeah, .org. Both. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Okay, maybe somebody can explain this to me. Some things I'm really smart about, some things I'm really dumb about. I'm missing something here. And It's Anything Goes Friday, and actually every single line is filled right now. So as I pick up your phone calls, as you hear people hang up, you can call in. But I'm going to get to your calls in just a second, it being Anything Goes Friday. But here's what I don't understand. The House of Representatives just passed a bill that continues the government operating, albeit crippled with a sequester, until December 15th, at which time they get to have a whole nother hostage taking, right? And takes the money out of Obamacare, defunds Obamacare. They're sending it to the Senate. Now, if the Senate passes that bill, then it becomes law, and the president can either sign it or veto it. He said he'd veto it. But nonetheless, if the Senate passes it, it passes. And people who want it to pass, they stand up and they give a short speech and say, I'm all in favor of this, and they try to make it pass. If the Senate wants to stop that law or amend that law to, for example, take out the part that says no Obamacare, then somebody filibusters it, right? I mean, you filibuster things to block legislation. Or am I missing something here? Because Ted Cruz, who just tweeted that he loves the House bill, the senator, the Canadian senator from Texas, Ted Cruz, is saying that he's going to filibuster it in the Senate. Now, why do you filibuster something you like? I don't understand. What am I missing? Or is it just that Ted Cruz sees this as a high-profile opportunity to get a bunch of FaceTime on TV? That's the only explanation I can come up with, is that this is just a stunt. This is purely an effort to get his face on television as much as possible. Ted Cruz is trying to be as famous as possible, as fast as possible, and he doesn't care who he has to step on to get there. He's kind of the Senate variation of Daryl Issa. And, you know, at the end of the day, the consequences are rather pathetic, and a lot of the behavior is, too. I don't know. Maybe somebody has a suggestion or a solution. Jason in Arlington, Virginia. You spoke to Representative Justin Amash, the Republican from Michigan?
Yeah, he was giving a speech at LPAC yesterday, and he was going over the...
What's LPAC?
Which members... Liberty Political Action Committee.
So one of the conservative... One of the conservative PACs, yeah. Got it.
No, it's libertarians.
I wouldn't okay, libertarian. All right.
So the interesting thing that happened was he was talking about the NSA and, you know, the depths to which our own government is preventing people such as him who have security accesses from finding out information. And he was saying that, like, if you go to the intelligence committee and you ask them a question, unless the question is phrased in the right way, you can ask a question four different ways, get a no, and then you phrase it the right way on the fifth way, and then you get your answer.
Right. Right.
And I said, well, who are these people that are, you know, not wanting to share this information? And he goes, it's members of both parties that basically been in Washington for a very long period of time and most view the new people coming in who want to have access to this information and knows a lot of this, or, you know, maybe, you know, be fully informed before they vote, that they almost take a parental role, like, we're the parents, you're the kids, we'll show you what we want.
Sure.
They
yeah, and that's certainly the attitude, you know, that I got from Dianne Feinstein saying, you know, about Syria, I've seen things you haven't seen. And then, you know, Alan Grayson came on this program and said, well, I've seen the same things Dianne Feinstein's seen. I can, you know, there's no there.
The important part of what he said, though, was it's authoritarians, for the most part, in both parties that are doing this and hijacking the government.
Sure.
It's not one party or the other.
No, I agree with you. I agree with you.
And what I think we're going to find out about it is a lot of the stuff with the Syria and the NSA votes that came down is that we are running into this period of time where it does appear that there are more, it's more of an authoritarian versus a libertarian situation.
Yeah, it's the authoritarian, the authoritarian traditional big D Democratic Party, big R Republican Party folks, the Dianne Feinsteins and John McCains of the party, versus the libertarian and progressive, I don't have a anti-authoritarian, you know, the Progressive Caucus, the Janczykowskis of the world, the, you know, and on the Republican side, the Justin Amashes of the world, the Libertarian Caucus, essentially. And this is going to be a very, very interesting dynamic. If history is any indicator, absent a popular revolution, and I'm not talking about people, you know, rising up with guns, but, you know, like the Reagan Revolution or the FDR Revolution, but absent a popular revolution of some sort, or even you could say there was a revolution around the end of the Nixon administration when, you know, with the Church Committee hearings and all these laws that were passed to open government up, that absent that happening at the grassroots level, the institutional, authoritarian, big D, big R party folks are going to win this game, Jason. And that's my...
I view the other people as those that want just something as simple as transparency.
Yeah, and I agree. And the anti-authoritarian ones are saying we would like transparency, and I'm with them. And maybe I'm not even anti-authoritarian. I mean, maybe that's too strong a word, but the pro-transparency people. I'll go along with that. Jason, thanks for the call. Interesting note. Michael in Imperial Beach, California. Hey, Michael, what's up?
Hey, Mr. Hartman. I'll take your bait. I'd like to get at three things about the illness you were talking about that's running the Republicans and the Wall Street, the masters of the universe.
Okay.
First, Wedeco is the mental illness, as you know. But when them, the masters of the universe, see last week at the U.S. Open, Serena Williams and Rafa Nadal making $2.6 million for playing one tennis tournament, this week they're seeing the golfers at the FedEx Cup possibly winning $10 million for winning one tournament, then the masters of the universe have to match, if not surpass them. Do you think this is what is partially drives the evil Wall Street Wetico?
Well, first of all, for people who don't know what you're talking about, Michael, Wetico is a word that Professor Jack Forbes shared with me back in 1995 when I was writing The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight. And he's deceased now, but he was a professor of Native American studies. He was Native American himself. And he said it was a word that was used, I think it's a Lakota Sioux word, that describes the mental illness that the Europeans brought with them to this continent from Europe. And it basically means one who consumes the life force of others, the cannibal, and the difficulty in challenging that. I don't disagree with that characterization, Michael. I would say, though, that all of these things are not only symptoms of Wetico, of a dysfunctional culture and but all that, but there's actually a fairly simple solution. There was a time in American history and world history when you didn't see individual sports, individual athletes or even individual rock stars making billions or hundreds of millions or tens of millions of dollars. And the reason why was because the top tax rate was well over 50% in the United States, in the UK, all across Europe, and all the major developed countries in the world. And so people would make their first million a year or their first 2 million or 3 million a year at a tax rate of 30, 40, 50%. But once it got above 50% and started hitting that 74% that it was at when Reagan came into office, or that 91% that it was at when Nixon came into office, people pretty much said, okay, 3 million a year is enough for me. And they let their workers have more money and put their money back into their companies. So that's my take on that. Michael, thanks for the call. Say that again. Oh, 10 seconds. Oh my. Marty, I'm going to put you back on hold. Hang on just a second here, and because that would not be fair. So if we want to solve this Wetico problem, if we want to solve this mental illness of just, amassing great wealth without end, there's a simple solution. And we have done it in the United States. Abraham Lincoln was the first to introduce it, although not in a big way. It was to fund the Civil War, but to do it as a matter of public policy, Woodrow Wilson, after World War, or through World War I, progressive taxation, a top tax rate of 91% on everything you take after your first $3 million, even if you take it as capital gains. That's what we need.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You can boil it down to 5 words. Roll back the Reagan tax cuts. Maybe that's 6 words. Whatever. Minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you and Gloria in Roberts, Illinois. Hey, Gloria, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to call you because you said, was asking the question whether Republicans were terrorists, and I just wanted to confirm it. I just wanted to tell you what my family has gone through with a Republican county that I live in. 2005. They broke into a building on my property that was padlocked without any kind of a search warrant. And I want you to know that I have never committed a crime, never been suspected or accused of a crime. That ended up costing me like $10,000. In 2007, my daughter was involved in a civil trial. And 2 weeks after it was over with, the judge informed her that she's not entitled to fair trial, or at least a jury that is not slanted.
A jury of her peers. Gloria, what does this have to do with the U.S. House of Representatives?
That has to do with the Republican Party.
Because I see.
That's what I live under.
Oh, I see. So it's just a very, very hard right, old boy network there.
We don't even have a Democratic Party in my county.
Oh, my. Well, Gloria, thank you for calling, and thank you for sharing the stories with us. I appreciate it. Marty in Evergreen Park, Illinois. Hey, Marty. Thanks for listening to WCPT. What's up?
Hey, thanks for taking my call. Happy Friday.
Thank you.
I just had a quick question. I'm trying to get my head around what the Fed is doing with this whole quantitative easing.
And their policy of buying mortgage-backed securities and government bonds, right? Mm-hmm. And I got to thinking about this. So if the government is spending all of this money buying mortgage-backed securities, in essence, buying people's houses, right? How are these banks?
No, they're not buying. They're not buying the original mortgages. They're buying the bets on the mortgages, and they're buying the bad bets on the mortgages to help get them off the books of the banksters who still have trillions of dollars worth of these bad bets on their books. So what the Fed is doing is twofold. You know, by buying treasuries, they're you know, becoming another holder of treasuries in the United States. They're also helping drive down, as opposed to foreign holders of treasuries and things like that, they're also driving down the interest rate of treasury bills, and by increasing the demand for them. And secondly, the consumption of them, and by buying these toxic assets, these toxic securities. Oh, and the big thing is they make a profit for the banksters when they do that, because by law, the Fed can't buy U.S. treasuries without buying them through a bank which charges a fee. Okay, so $45 billion every single, what is it, month, or is it weekly? It's either one or the other that the quantitative easing is happening. Is it a monthly or weekly? Do you remember?
I thought it was I heard 85 billion.
It's a total of 85 billion. It's a 45 billion worth of bonds and 40 billion worth of mortgage-backed securities, bad derivatives. So, by doing these two things, they're basically it's the old boy network. They're propping up the banksters. They're inflating the economy. This economy is being held together with spit and baling wire. You know, it's bubble gum and scotch tape. And the minute the Fed begins unwinding this, today the article in the Financial Times is the Fed may start backing off quantitative easing as early as October. Well, that hasn't spooked the market terribly yet, or actually I haven't checked to see where the market closed at today. But, you know, when they said we're not going to stop QE, then the market was like, oh, boy, more free money, you know. This is, you know, it's the banksters helping out the banksters. That's what's going on here, Marty.
Well, and then where's the help for, like, people? I was thinking, like, how can they even still foreclose on, you know, on some of these bad mortgages?
Legally, they can't.
What's the help for the
legally, they shouldn't be able to. And in fact, there's a growing movement in the United States where people are saying, in fact, you can Google or DuckDuckGo, show me the paper, right? Show me the documents. Where, you know, the bank comes to you and they say, we're going to foreclose in your home. And you say, show me the document that says that you own this house. And some significant number, percentage of the time, 9 times out of 10 or whatever, some huge percentage of the time, they cannot do it because your mortgage got sliced and diced into 1,000 pieces. And each one of those pieces got sold into a separate pool, a separate tranched pool called a securitized mortgage, collateralized debt obligation. And then those got tranched, and they got sold into these other derivatives, and until, you know, a couple million or a couple billion dollars, rather, worth of mortgages in the United States became a couple hundred trillion dollars worth of these derivatives, and they just can't show the paper. And you've got occasionally in the United States a judge who will stand up and say they can't take your home, they can't prove that they own it, but most people don't have the money or the time or the knowledge to fight the banks on this kind of thing. And the government is not helping because the government is all about the banksters, because the government is run by politicians. And in our constitutional monarchy here, our monarchs, the 9 justices of the Supreme Court, a majority of them, 5 out of the 9, have said that these banksters have rights under the Constitution, have human rights under the Constitution, and that one of those rights is free speech, and that free speech can be exercised by giving money to politicians or spending money on behalf of politicians. And so that's why we've got a situation where the government is doing everything it can to bail out the banksters, who are among the very largest political donors in Washington, D.C., and among the richest people in the world, and on an income basis, probably the richest people in the world in terms of the amount of money they're able to skim off the top every day from what they're doing. And there's all kinds of examples of fraud. Like, you know, a couple of days ago when they announced that QE, the quantitative easing, was not going to be discontinued, it was announced at 2 o'clock. The Chicago Board of Trade is 5 milliseconds slower. It takes 5 milliseconds longer 5/1000ths of a second longer for the Chicago Board of Trade area, for Chicago to get the news, than it does for New York to get the news, because the news is released from Washington, D.C. It takes 2 milliseconds to get to New York, 5 milliseconds to get to Chicago. So when people started buying in the marketplace based on that news, it should have been 5 milliseconds late in Chicago, 2 milliseconds late in New York. They weren't. They both occurred at the exact same time, which means that the fix was in. The fix has always been in. As Elizabeth Warren said, people think that the system is rigged. The system is absolutely rigged. And nobody's going to jail over it because they're just too rich. Marty, thank you for the call. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Either Albert Einstein was wrong and the speed of light is not constant, or somebody's gaming the system with regard to the stock market. By the way, Monday, I will not be here. And we will have a live show. Dr. Mike's going to fill in for me? Yep. Dr. Mike is going to fill in for me. Pardon? Yes, and Dr. Mike is going to be filling in for Dr. Tom. And here's why I won't be here, because Sunday I'll be flying home. I'll be on an airplane on Monday. And because Sunday I'm going out to Port Townsend, Washington, where Goddard College, as part of their 150th anniversary celebration, is awarding their first honorary Ph.D., in Humane Arts and Letters, to me. Hey, not bad. Where'd you get that from? In fact, Goddard says, as we celebrate our 150th year, Goddard is especially proud to welcome Tom Hartman to our Port Townsend, Washington campus as part of the graduation ceremonies for the inaugural class of Goddard's newest academic endeavor, our undergraduate program on the West Coast. This is from Barbara Vicars, who is the president of the college. Goddard College will grant an honorary doctorate of humane letters to award-winning author and internationally recognized progressive radio talk show host Tom Hartman. And we are proud to honor Tom for his lifelong commitment to progressive values. Goddard's progressive pedagogy is an inquiry-based lifelong learning model where the act of questioning assumptions and examining the stories that shape us is a vital component of our educational mission. We salute Tom and his pioneering contribution to progressive journalism and exposing the concealed narratives that are so critical to preservation of our democracy. That's sweet. The press release is over at the Goddard.edu website. If any of you out there on the Wikipedia world are inclined to add it to my Wikipedia, I try not to edit my own Wikipedia page. I don't ever want to get accused of it turning it into a vanity page. And so it's one of those rare occasions where I've asked somebody to actually, if you know how to do it, you know, if you got an account, you can find I'm proud of this. This is kind of cool. I mean, at the end of the day, an honorary PhD doesn't, you know, it's not like I'm going to get a job offer from Harvard to teach anything, but it's nice to be recognized for, you know, busting my butt all these years to spread the message of small d democracy. And I mean, they're talking about things, you know, the various things that I've done, culture and, you know, ADHD and democracy and on, I guess, last hours of ancient sunlight, peak oil, rebooting the American dream, progressive values, you name it. So anyhow, my bragging rights moment. So I've known about this for a while. I didn't want to go off on it at some length, and I probably won't much talk about it again, but just mostly I wanted to thank Goddard. You know, it's a real honor. It is a real honor. And so, by the way, if you're looking for a good progressive college, Goddard, Goddard.edu, Goddard is one incredible college. I got to know them when Louise and I lived in Vermont. There was a young woman who was working on her master's degree, and she needed a mentor. I forget the exact word for it. And she was writing it on ADHD, her thesis on attention deficit disorder. And she contacted Louise and I and said, you know, would you guys help us out? Louise actually, this was before we started the radio show. Louise was working as an ADHD coach for business people who had ADD. And I was, you know, I'd written books on it, and I was traveling around the country speaking on it. And so I became a member, and they had to give me some sort of a faculty position in order to do this. And I forget the exact title for it. I think it's on the wiki page. It's on my bio someplace. That was the beginning of my association with Goddard. It's when I first got to know them, and I used to go out, and they have their own radio station there. I used to go out and hang out on their radio station a lot and be a guest on a lot of the local shows. So anyhow, that's what's up. So that's why I won't be here on Monday. Mary Jo in Minneapolis. Hey, Mary Jo, thanks for listening to Minnesota's Progressive Voice, AM 950. What's up?
Hi, Tom. Congratulations on your honorary PhD. You deserve many more of those.
Well, thank you. It'll be Dr. Tom after Monday. No, it won't
yes,
be. It won't
Dr.
be.
Tom. Yes. Well, I'm calling hoping you can help me give a response to Eric Paulson, who is our representative.
Mm-hmm.
And he wrote a response in to my questioning, you know, what they were doing with the SNAP program. And he always gives very weaselly answers, and I'm trying to drive a nail through some of what he said, but I really don't have all the facts, so I'm wondering if I could just read a couple of these and you could tell me how truthful this
sure.
is.
Sure. So this is what your Republican member of the House of Representatives said to you about food stamps, SNAP.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm going to skip some of it, but oh, okay. He says, this bill increases funding for food banks by $330 million.
You mean the bill that he's supporting?
Yeah.
Okay. It may well do that. $330 million is nothing when you're talking about stripping $4 billion out of the legislation.
So $4 billion. Okay. Yeah. That's what I needed to know. Things like that. Thank you. And he said, second,
actually, it's even more than $4 billion. Let's just leave it with $4 billion. So go ahead.
Okay.
Continue.
That helps. You should be aware that spending on SNAP has increased by 100% in 5 years. And, of course, I know that's because the poverty has increased.
Yeah, it's thanks for the Bush recession. Yeah,
right.
Of course.
The reforms in this bill will only reduce spending on the SNAP program by 5%. Now, is that truthful? I mean,
I don't know. I would be surprised if it's not truthful. I don't know why a member of the House would lie, but 5%, if let's see. If it's going to kick 3 million people off the program, and there's, 46 million people, I think, in the United States who are living below the poverty line, and so presumably they're all eligible for food stamps, and so 5% would be somewhere in the neighborhood of 2.5 million people. So, yeah, that's probably about right.
Well, that's a lot then.
Yes.
All right.
I wouldn't say it's only going to cut it by 5%. I say it's going to massively cut it by 5%. 3 million people.
Right. Yeah, and he says by 5% and are tied directly to the same reforms included in the successful bipartisan welfare reforms passed under President Clinton.
Yes, that's
so he always likes.
Yeah, there's a person. You know, this is one of those, you know, figures don't lie, but liars can figure. Bill Clinton passed. Yes, he ended welfare as we know it. What he did is he said that you can't be on welfare indefinitely. Even if you're disabled, even if you're mentally ill, even if, you know, whatever, or especially if you're well, right? And you can't be on welfare indefinitely. You have to start showing up and proving that you're trying to get a job. Welfare became time limited. And that really wasn't that much of a problem in the 90s because we had an unemployment rate around 3 or 4%, you know, which is just basically the people who don't want to work. And or, you know, it reflects parts of the country where you're just never going to get out of unemployment. And so the big problem with Clinton's welfare reforms was because they time limited welfare. And that's what they want to do with food stamps. They want to say you can only be on food stamps for a maximum of 3 months. And then you've got to start proving that you're looking for a job. And the problem with that is that when you're in a recession like we are right now, where you've got 14% on and underemployment, and, you know, 7, 8, 9, 10% real unemployment, if you look, depending on who's, you know, which numbers you're looking at from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, it becomes punitive. You know, it's not helpful. And so Clinton's welfare reforms, I think, you know, they were fine for a time when the economy was good, but they have really hurt people right now. People are hurting right now as a result of the Clinton welfare reforms. So if he's bragging that he's following in the footsteps of Bill Clinton, That may sound good for a Republican, or he may think it sound good for a Democrat, but it's actually a bad thing. Back to you.
Okay, so he says, in addition, now I haven't heard anything about this, this bill also included a bipartisan provision I authored with Representative McCollum, who's our Democratic representative, to help disabled low-income seniors who are unable to leave their homes use SNAP benefits to get the food they need by allowing nonprofit organizations to deliver to their home. This permits nonprofit groups like Minnesota's Store to Door to actively assist homebound seniors. So it
right.
makes it sound like, well, right. you know, those people are being taken care of.
Right. It's sort of, you know, it's sort of like saying, you know, like the guy here at Navy Yard a couple of days ago. It's sort of like, you know, if he was still around and he was still alive, which he's not, saying, yeah, I went in there and I killed 12 people. But before I did, I pat my dog.
Yeah, right.
You know, I was very nice to him. I fed him. Well, Hitler loved dogs, you know.
Yeah.
Not that I would compare your congressman to Hitler. He's nowhere near as charismatic.
Oh, yeah. Oh, he just riles me no end. All right. Well, thank you very much. I will compose a letter to send not only to him, but to our local Sun newspaper in Edina's here. So thank you very much,
sure.
Tom.
You're welcome. Thank you for
so
the
much.
Call.
Bye.
Mary Jo. And we only have about 20 seconds of the break, so not enough time for another caller, although there's a bunch of you stacked up. But like I said, this is the weasel words are astounding. Why don't Republicans have the courage to simply say, we think welfare creates dependency on government, and therefore we're not going to give it to people because we don't think people should be dependent on government? I mean, that's really what they're thinking. And actually, there's some truth to that. Among 1, 2, 3% of the population, historically, you find that there's going to be a certain number of freeloaders, right? I'm willing to say that if 1% of the program is abused, I'll keep the other 99%. Republicans aren't. Why don't we just be honest about this?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
You go back and read Ben Franklin's autobiography. He went to England and he was shocked by the welfare programs. He started talking, we've been having this conversation for 250 years. Welcome back. Thanks so much to our show director, Louise Hartman, to my executive producer, Sean Taylor, to our associate producers, Shane Farnan and Danielle Gilday, to our video director, Jim Javinsky, to our writer-researchers, Andrew Campbell and Nate Sweet, to Alva Goldberg for video production, to our webmasters, Nigel Peacock and Jamie Holly, to our business manager, Ron Hartenbaum, to everyone at all the various companies that syndicate this program, Westwood One on commercial radio stations, Pacifica Radio on non-commercial stations, Sirius XM satellite radio, CRN Network on cable systems all over the country, Free Speech TV on Dish Network, DirecTV, all the cable providers who carry our show, simulcast as television, Comcast, Manhattan Neighborhood Networks, and the others around the country, to all the great folks at Free Speech TV and RTTV who work on The Big Picture, to our newsletter editor, Sue Nethercutt, to the folks in our chat room. Hey, to Ellen Ratner and Victoria Jones and everyone at the Talk Radio News Service, to Jay Goodman Tamboli for tech support, to our affiliates, our sponsors, and especially to you for supporting our program. We would not be here without you. Thank you. And that said, back to Anything Goes Friday. Tim in Rockville, Tennessee. Hey, Tim, what's up?
Hello, Tom. Excuse my voice. Bear with me. I listen to you because I like to hear both sides. You know how you've heard that before?
Sure. In other words, you consider yourself a conservative.
That's a lie.
Okay.
I'm telling you a lie because your BS detector is pretty good, right?
Generally.
That's what I've heard today is lies. And I called my representative's office in Washington, D.C. today, Representative Scott DeJarlais, serial adulterer.
D or R?
News. Pardon?
Is he a Democrat or Republican?
No, he's a Republican.
Okay.
All the way. And you probably heard him in the news.
Yeah, I think so. I think I know who you're talking about. Yeah.
Yeah. And anyways, I got a lady on the phone, and I told her, asked her about my concerns about this votes on the food stamps and on defunding Obamacare. And she put me through to somebody else. And it was a very slick guy that probably had all the talking points down. And basically what he told me is a number of things. They're not cutting food stamps. They're just slowing down the growth of food stamps. So I figured that's one lie that I've heard today.
Yeah, I mean, it's right not because this bill is spread out over a decade. It's conceivable that technically he's telling the truth, although for the next 12 months, it's going to be a cut.
But it's pretty much weasel words, like you were saying.
Yes,
before.
It is. I don't understand why they don't just tell the truth. Why don't they just say, we don't think that food stamps are a good idea. We don't think people should be dependent on the government. We don't think it's the job of government to be there for people when they're in trouble. That's what churches are supposed to do. That's what friends and neighbors are supposed to do. It's not the role of government. Why don't they just say that? This is what they believe.
Exactly.
I mean, I disagree with it, but I understand it. I used to have these debates with my dad. I mean, you know, come on. Man up. Tell the truth, damn it. Excuse me.
I asked him if he could just see it right to give people maybe a couple loaves and fishes, if that would be okay.
Right. Yeah. And he said our congressman is not Jesus, so it's not going to work, right?
No, he didn't have anything to say. He didn't reply, I don't think, to that one.
Yeah.
But that was my experience with my congressman.
Yeah, yeah, you got weaseled, Tim. If they say anything other than with regard to food stamps or any of these other, you know, government entitlement programs, you know, Medicare, Medicaid, Obamacare, Social Security, if they say anything other than my philosophy is that you're on your own and it's not the role of government to do anything other than have a military and do the police, they are lying. And I don't understand why they feel the need to lie, other than the fact that they know that the polls show that only about 5 or 10% of people in America actually agree with that point of view. And by the way, those are the 5 or 10% of people in America who make over $100,000 a year. So, you know, who can afford to say, well, yeah, sure, screw them, you know. Tim, thanks a lot for the call. Les in Dallas, Texas. Let's see on KPPK. Hey, Les, what's up?
Good afternoon.
Hey.
I had two or three things. Earlier you were talking about fracking and wells and chemicals. People don't seem to know where all those big tanks full of toxic chemicals are coming from that are used for fracking operations. It's my understanding that the chemicals are a byproduct of
refining operations.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The refiners found a way to get rid of that stuff without having to destroy it.
Yeah, well, they used to have to pay to destroy that stuff. It used to be called toxic waste, and it could be as much as $2,000 a pound to destroy some of those lower high fractions of petroleum. And now they not only don't have to pay to dispose of it, they can charge a small fee to sell it to the fracking companies. You're right.
Right. Ship it out and pump it in.
Yep.
Second, I've heard a lot of people impugning politicians today, and I resent that. I think we have some of the best politicians money can buy.
Yeah, good line. Good line. You and Will Rogers. I think he was either him or Tom. Who's Mark Twain? One or the other was the first one to say that. Good line.
Out of what I'm calling about to begin with.
Okay.
The Republicans are very, very good at coming up with two-word labels they catch on,
right.
Like job killer. That's the most recent one.
Right, death panels.
Yeah, death panels, flip-flopper.
Right.
I would love to hear all the progressive talk radio people referring to the Republican Depression of 29, which, by the way, or the early 30s, my understanding is that's what it was called before the GOP raised such a stink that they threatened to sue anybody that said it in public.
I don't know if they could sue anybody, but they did raise a stink about it. And, yes, it was referred to as the Bush recession, typically, or the Republican recession or depression. And
yeah.
And back in the 30s, by the way, Franklin Roosevelt and people around him, they used to refer to it as the Republican recession. In fact, we got a clip around here someplace of FDR. No, it was Harry Truman. We got Harry Truman talking about this Republican Depression, you know. It's like, yeah, they used to call it that. And then in the 50s, it went out of fashion with the Eisenhower presidency when the Republican Party kind of reformed themselves and got rid of their crazies. But they were full bore tilt, full boogie crazy in 1947, 48, and that Congress, the do-nothing Congress that passed, that didn't do nothing. They passed Taft-Hartley, which was incredibly destructive. Les, thanks for the call. Much appreciated. And thanks for listening to your local Pacifica station. Coming up Monday, the latest news information for the weekend, plus the Obamacare exchanges go into effect. David Sand is going to be here to answer your questions. Dr. Mike is going to be filling in while I'm getting my PhD. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. Get out there, get active, and occupy something. I'll see you Tuesday.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.